So, welcome to the Total Bitcoin podcast show. My name is Kevin Davani. I'm really looking forward to a talk with Parker Lewis, whom I've been, waiting for a long time. He's a colleague of Phil Geiger from Unchained Capital. They're both really brilliant minds, written, beautiful articles. Some of them, you should definitely read them yourself. Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme. Bitcoin cannot be copied. Bitcoin is not backed by nothing. Bitcoin is not for criminals. Bitcoin cannot be banned. So there's, a range of articles you should read for yourself. It really goes deep into the rabbit hole, and you get a really bigger and much more, a detailed understanding, comprehension of why Bitcoin, what are the root causes, what are the monetary properties of Bitcoin? Why is it an inevitable necessity, as Parker Lewis says? So without further ado, if you like it, love it, please share it, follow me, subscribe, and I would also really appreciate any kind of feedback or positive review. So yeah, this is my interview with Parker Lewis. Thank you so much, and talk to you soon again. Bye. So, Parker, thanks so much for your time. Welcome to the Total Bitcoin Show. My very special guest, Parker Lewis. How are you doing, man?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on. I know I've been trying to do this for a couple months now, but glad that it finally worked. All the things that you talk about on the podcast are things that I'm interested in. So always wanted to come on, but glad that we could finally make it happen.
Yeah, eagerly I've been waiting for this because I've been having a talk with your colleague here from Unchained Capital, Phil Geiger. It was also very educational talk, very exciting. So listen,
Yeah,
Mark,
he came on about a month ago. Is that right? Yeah. I remember listening to it, but I couldn't remember exactly when it was.
Exactly. So Parker, so I listened to the interview also you did with Marty Bent. I had to re-listen to it like, I don't know, two or three times, and it was so succinct that I had to re-listen, re-listen. So can you maybe for my listeners do a like a short summary of what is the like the essential messages in that interview you gave with Marty Bent? Because I think it's really important what's going on.
Yeah, I think that if there is one takeaway, or to abbreviate some of the discussion that I had with Marty, essentially what happened from 2009 to 2017 was that the Fed increased the size of its balance sheet by approximately 3.6 trillion, from around 900 billion to 4.5 trillion. Then from the period from October of 2017 through the summer of 19 into September of 2019, the Fed started to drain $50 billion a month from its balance sheet. And that ultimately resulted in 700 billion in total being removed from the US economy and ultimately the global economy. And as the dollar is not only the largest economic system in the world, it's also the largest funding currency and is the largest, source of credit in the world. And so essentially what had happened was Fed went from extremely easy monetary policy to draining liquidity very quickly, and having reduced approximately 700 billion of liquidity out of the system over the course of October 2017 to September 2019. Eventually, one of the short-term funding markets, which is a very large market, the repo market, in my terminology, it just broke. Suddenly, overnight, rates spiked from 3% to somewhere between 9 and 10%, depending on where you look at the marks. And essentially, what that means is for the repo market is a very large funding market, and suddenly there were no lenders in that market, or there were, but the rates at which those that it was required to induce sufficient liquidity to satisfy the demand suddenly increased significantly. And so overnight, the people that were paying for liquidity in that market, their rate of interest doubled to nearly tripled. And as a result, the Fed had to come back in and start putting liquidity back into the system as a whole, but specifically to that market to stave off essentially a run on that market that would have bled into other markets.
Gotcha. So how long can this
if I abstract that to a higher level, what it ultimately means is there's one thing that quantitative easing was the increase in the size of the balance sheet from, and it's not just the Fed. I'm more familiar with the Fed, so I have these numbers on the top of my head, but what the Fed's doing, the ECB is doing, exactly. To probably it's more pervasive for a number of reasons, and the Bank of Japan may be the worst of them all. So, I usually talk specifically about the Fed because it's something that, really going down the rabbit hole, that's where I spent most of my time, but it's the exact same rabbit hole. So what the things that are systemic and involved with the Fed are it's equally as true for the ECB, maybe different, but true. And then similarly for the BOJ, but the high level takeaway is that it's really a dynamic of there is too much debt in the system. And in order to be able to satisfy that amount of debt, the Fed, the ECB, the BOJ, they will always have to put more dollars, more euros, more yen into the system. The whole system is based on credit. That is the source of demand for the base money. But ultimately, QE, it can only solve a problem one way. It can only solve a problem by inducing more credit to be created. It's the solution to there is too much debt, so we need more base currency. But that base currency that they put in the system, the only way it's designed to work is to actually increase the total amount of debt. And then it's kind of a vicious cycle. Okay, we have too much debt, we need more dollars, or we have too much euro debt, we need more euros. And then they supply more dollars or euros, and then the size of the credit system expands from there. And so it's kind of a constant push and pull type system. Ultimately, it will end very badly, but it is the dynamic between the size of the credit system and the size of the underlying base money that, a lot of people could look at it, from the outside and say, well, how can the ECB create 5 trillion euros, or how can and I don't know that's a specific amount. I think it's something between 3 and 4 trillion euros, or how could the Fed create 3.6 trillion euros and not see this instant by orders of magnitude inflation? And really the reason for that is because it's always about the relationship between the amount of actual base money and the size of the credit system. And in either system, whether it's the euro, the dollar, or the yen's financial system, the marginal price setter is the credit system, because there is so much more credit than there is actual base money.
Mm-hmm. What's the actual base money? Let's just to stay in the United States. What would that be? Because I was surprised, I think, at the figures. Was it like 1.6 or 1.7 trillion?
And this is something else that it's important to think about. Not all base money is the same, and especially not as it relates to the banking system. So right now, I'd have to check, but because the Fed's increasing the base money very rapidly. So the Fed, if we start with the Fed's balance sheet is somewhere around 4.2 trillion. Okay. But, and essentially what that is there's, on one side of the Fed's balance sheet, there's factor supplying reserves, factor supplying dollars. And then there's the other side, which is, well, where are those dollars? And so in the banking system today, again, depending on what the Fed has done in the last month, which has been fairly extreme, the amount of cash in the banking system is somewhere around 2 to 2.2 trillion. Before, when the repo market broke, it was 1.6 trillion. The Fed has since increased, depending on, stick your finger up what day of the week it is, has put in approximately $400 million to $500 million, or billion, sorry, of new dollars, such that the banks now have between $2 to $2.2 trillion. But there's this other piece of the Fed's balance sheet, which is, so if the Fed has $4.2 trillion of reserves that they've supplied to the market, only $2.2 trillion of those exists in the banking system. There's another approximately $2 trillion that exists outside the banking system. So that is, as you know, if I think about it at a micro level, if I go take money out of the bank, and I don't put it back in the bank, then that money essentially converts from a reserve to a physical note. It's still a factor supplying a reserve in terms of the Fed's balance sheet, but for most purposes, dollars that come out of the banking system and that don't re-enter, so approximately, and this is a crazy number, but approximately 90 billion a year net is taken out of the banks just by people demanding cash. Because that's another thing that people generally don't understand. It should be fairly obvious, but the dollar in your that's underneath your mattress or that's in your hand is very different than the deposit that's sitting in your bank account. One has one level of counterparty risk, one has two. But I bring that point up because oftentimes people look at the Fed's balance sheet or the ECB and they think about that as, oh, well, there's this much money in the system. The money that sits outside the banking system can't really service the liabilities that exist in the banking system. So on one side, it's important to look at, well, what is the total situation, which is the Fed's balance sheet and the factor supplying reserve, which are $4.2 trillion-ish today. But the more important piece as it relates to the banking system is the cash that the banks actually have. So I think about that as the left side of the bank's balance sheet, the actual reserves or physical cash that the banks hold, because their liquidity source in aggregate is ultimately what can satisfy the liabilities that exist in the banking system, such that if the banks in total have 2.2 to 2.2 trillion of cash, but there's 73 to 75 trillion of debt and you know, financial debt, it's not the 4.2 that can satisfy the 75, it's the 2. And what happened when the Fed was shrinking the size of its balance sheet, it had ultimately taken approximately 30% of all liquidity out of the system. And that ultimately, you know, very logically, very predictably, you know, it becomes unpredictable when you want to pick the day of the week or the market specifically that breaks. But very obviously that if you have a very over-leveraged system, okay, by stripping out 30 to 40% of liquidity, depending on how you look at liquidity, and liquidity impacts different markets in different ways, and markets fragment, that the logical end game of QE is there will just always be more dollars or more euros or more yen, because the solution that is QE can only cause one thing, can only be successful in one way, which is to expand the size of the overall credit system, which then ultimately dictates the need for more QE.
Got it. Okay. So we'll come back, I think, to some of the details later on, but is it correct to say that this whole cancerous, you know, debt credit-based system is so intricately interconnected, interlocked with one another? I mean, could we say that is there some sort of assessment, like maybe even within the Unchained Capital, have you done studies like where could this crash first? Is it going to be the EU or I mean, are there like projections for this?
No, I mean, I think that there's probably some sophisticated hedge funds out there that have views. I don't have a view. I think that the way that I approach my, you know, not only my time, but my thinking is like, I know that this is out there, it's almost like not trading in the sense of day trading, but in terms of how you operate through those things. Know that, you know, it at some point there is going to be another financial crisis just by the setup. If you become paralyzed such that you're always focused on it, rather than figuring out to say, okay, if this is an inevitability, I don't know exactly what that looks like. I don't know if it's going to be as bad as 2008. Obviously, the Fed has jumped in far quicker today to try to stem that tide. I do think that it's an inevitability, but I also don't say, okay, well, you know, when does this happen and where exactly does it happen? Because ultimately what I believe is that Bitcoin is the solution to it. And so I could sit around and worry about, you know, the how, what, or when of it. But if, you know, if I think about playing through that wave, that the place that makes the most sense to focus my own time is not to get hung up necessarily on that, to be cognizant of it, to pay attention of it, because it will impact all of us. And I think people certainly have to plan for that end state, but they don't necessarily need to, you know, be wondering, because I think then it becomes it just becomes counterproductive. Whereas if you can focus on what you ultimately think is the fix, it doesn't matter when everybody else figures it out. Is that that's just the force of gravity, and the time function, you know, right, will take care of itself.
Got it. So let's go to your articles, your amazing articles. Let me see where that is. Oh, there we go. So you've written really some amazing articles that went pretty viral, in my opinion. I send it to all kinds of people of mine, and, you know, for comprehension, because it's about comprehension, it's like levels of comprehension. Let's see, let me put this here. So I'm not sure the order, the consecutive order of your articles, but one of them is Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme. Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme. The other one, Bitcoin cannot be copied. Bitcoin is not backed by nothing. And Bitcoin is not for criminals. Is there any other article I left out, like that is should have mentioned?
I think I've put out 11 or 12 to this point, but we don't need to work through all of them. But you know, they can all be found on the Unchained Capital blog. But I do try to make them pretty self-contained, so there is some repetition in terms of themes from one to one, but they all try to articulate a particular point and work through that kind of logical, generally mental block within each article, so that someone can understand, you know, whether, you know, well, why isn't it for criminals, or why, you know, why is it not a pyramid scheme? And they're not necessarily all focused on debunking some flawed thinking around Bitcoin, but most of them are, and I really just, you know, structured it that way because I really didn't intend to do it. But then as I started to write and as I started to look at the, you know, just in terms of other things that have been written about Bitcoin, and as I was going around and having conversations both with clients or potential clients, I think all of us experience it, because most of us who have gotten to the point of our own understanding have had to pass through a lot of those kind of key fundamental questions as to what, right, Bitcoin is and what Bitcoin isn't.
Right. So I wrote down, I sent you my, my questions, my list of questions. I have a bunch of questions. The more I read it, because I read, I think, each one of your articles at least twice. So so when you say, yeah, so one of the most important articles, Bitcoin is not backed by nothing. In that article, we wrote about the sort of the dollar scarcity versus the Bitcoin or absolute scarcity of Bitcoin. And the supply of Bitcoin is entirely divorced from the function of credit. And I thought that's very important for, you know, for everybody, for every noob, for every Bitcoin beginner or listener to understand that, you know, that the supply of Bitcoin is entirely divorced or separated from the function of credit. And that, and also, you know, what I also loved is that you went into detail about the credibility of monetary properties. And what my question, I think, is credibility of monetary properties, understanding the credibility of monetary properties in relation to the, you know, the critical adoption phase, so critical adoption rate. Do you want to go a little bit deeper into this topic?
Yeah. So I think when I talk about absolute scarcity versus relative scarcity in that article, before even getting there, one of the key points to, you know, especially for people that are new to Bitcoin, you know, it's just this concept of what is money, you know, and it is something that, you know, and maybe the best singular thing about Bitcoin is that it forces people, if they actually want to understand it, to ask that question. Right? That almost has to be the first question. And more people that look at that problem, and more than just for a few kind of shallow seconds, that, you know, there are two general explanations, because it is an uncomfortable topic when people say, well, what is money? You know, some people get upset by it even. And that when they start to think about it, there's two kind of mainstream thought processes around it. It is that it's a collective hallucination, or that, you know, that people demand money because, you know, the government gives it value. And those are so shallow in terms of a thought process. If someone just tried to break that down to test the assumption of, like, wait, what do you mean we all just magically believe that this thing has value, so it does? It is, yes, value is subjective, but value is always relative because it is subjective. And then secondarily, if people break down the idea that you know, the dollar has value because the IRS taxes it, or because the guys with guns will come, you know, bang down your door. And again, that line of thinking completely breaks down if, you know, it doesn't prove the counterfactual, but if you look at all of the countries that have militaries, the ability to tax governments that may be repressive, that have currencies that have either hyperinflated or have lost significant purchasing power in their underlying currencies. And so the question is, well, if currencies derive their values as a function of government, why do these other governments suck so bad at it? And then the explanation becomes, oh, well, that was just monetary mismanagement. It wasn't the logical end game of every single fiat currency, because every fiat currency ultimately has the same underpinnings. Various different fiat currency systems are structurally more resilient because other countries have come to hold them as reserve, and there can be layers of mismanagement. But I think the key differentiation between, say, an Austrian view and a monetarist or a Keynesian view is the idea that any manipulation of the money supply is ultimately bad, and what you have in fiat systems is ultimately just various different degrees of mismanagement, not that there can be better management or worse management. And ultimately what that results in, and why certain fiat currencies are, you know, have emerged as reserve currencies, generally the euro, the dollar foremost, the euro, and then the yen, is because their underlying economies that those fiat systems arose from were inherently stronger, and then those systems developed, essentially they began as reserve-backed currencies, and then they slowly transitioned, and maybe slowly is not the right term, but over the course of approximately a century, all transitioned from reserve-backed currencies in some form or fashion to debt-backed currencies. And initially, the important point there is that all of them, all fiat currencies, whether it's the dollar, euro, yen, bolivar, lira, peso, none of them have any inherent monetary properties. And the fiat currencies that are stronger than the weaker ones, they all have large credit systems that, you know, ultimately allowed the underlying currency to become divorced from so it was formally, quote, backed by gold or some base metal, and it was a fractional representation, and then it transitioned, you know, slowly that ability to convert to gold or another base metal became restricted, and at that point in time there was sufficient amount of debt denominated in the currency itself that the quote backing of that currency became the debt. The debt becomes the future source of demand. And so today in all of those systems, the only thing you know, that, and I don't really like the term backed, but the only thing that creates stability in the dollar, the euro, the yen, or any fiat currency is the relationship between the supply of the underlying base money, the dollars or the euros, the yen, the left side of the bank's balance sheet, or the physical currency in your underneath your mattress, and the ultimate size of the credit system. And so because of that dynamic, it was what we were talking about before with QE, that the dollar is scarce. Like, even though the Fed has increased the amount of dollars by 400 to 500 billion in the last 3 months, the demand for the dollars and the need for dollars relative to the actual dollars that exist is very high on a relative basis. But because of that dynamic, it ensures that the absolute amount of dollars will continue to become less and less scarce. And not everybody is in debt or dependent on staying on that dollar hamster wheel. And the more people that figure that out, that say, hey, as this system exists, that the only way that it continues to sustain itself is the relationship between the dollars that exist and the dollar debt that exists. And if that ensures that the amount of dollars that exist will continue to grow over time, otherwise the entire system, the whole credit system collapses. Then over here on this other side, there's Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, one, is entirely, its scarcity and its monetary properties, they're both emergent, and then as they've emerged, then they become inherent. And it's a closed loop system. There is no outside credit system that's ultimately designed to create demand for it. Its scarcity, in a digital form, is inherent in and of itself. Originally, that scarcity and the property of scarcity, it was not always the fact that it was destined to be scarce, but it's grown to such a level, and the security and the decentralization of that security, which comes in many forms, not just mining, but also the distribution of the ownership of Bitcoin itself, that today and in each day that Bitcoin survives and more people adopt it, the more secure that scarcity becomes and the more divorced from it, any outside system it becomes. And so truly that system and what it is in Bitcoin creates absolute scarcity, but also creates what was emergent and now is inherent scarcity versus something like the dollar system or the euro or the yen, where the marginal cost to produce dollars, euro, or yen are the literal click of a button. So the marginal cost to create dollars is zero for all intents and purposes, and the nature of the credit system will only cause those dollars to become less and less scarce.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So for my listeners, I'm going to summarize. I wrote this actually out of your article, sort of as a note. Fixed supply plus increasing adoption equals increasing value. And as the value increases, the adoption increases, or I would call it critical adoption increases, and its value increases, and Bitcoin becomes further decentralized. And as it becomes more decentralized, it becomes harder to change, reinforcing the credibility of its foundation, its fixed supply. These are your words out of your article. I really love that, how you summarize that. So Parker, what I was going to ask you, yeah. So we heard some reports today, you might have heard, about this whole crisis in pending, looming war or the threat of war in Iran. So the reports came out of Iran that Bitcoin is trading between $24,000 and $29,000 per Bitcoin. So would that mean, some countries, like, let's say, we don't even need to talk about Iran, but let's say, hyperinflationary countries such as Venezuela. So people go to the most sellable, as Austrian economists would say, most sellable currency, and that would be sort of the dollar, because it's sort of, but it's changing now. People are more and more, I think, having the aha moment and going more to the hardest, scarcest and money ever created, and that is Bitcoin. Do you think once I mean, we hope not, you know, that there's not going to be a war erupting or somewhere, you know, in the Middle East or Iran or somewhere. But, you know, the side effect could be people are, do you think eventually people are going to be more attracted, gravitated towards Bitcoin instead of, you know, looking for other alternatives? And that would sort of, you know, trigger the chain reaction?
Yeah, I think that it's probably, there's a function of time and in a distribution of knowledge. And so there are probably two ways that Bitcoin gets adopted: out of necessity and for those who are put in that situation, whether it be in Venezuela and they're desperate to search for something because they need something now, or for people who have the luxury of being in more presently stable scenarios that generally have access to more information and that can take the time to learn about Bitcoin and to understand truly fundamentally, you know, why this is a thing and why it continues to gain strength and why it will likely be a global currency. But I do think that regardless of anything that anybody does individually, that, you know, if you operate under the assumption that money is a necessity, money is not a collective hallucination, it's that if you want any semblance of what our current lives look like and that you can show up to the grocery store and that there's, you know, thousands of different options that require the coordination of hundreds of millions of people, if you want anything, if people just stop and think about the function of money in that way, that they recognize that money is a tool, and that it is a tool that ultimately was invented by man very organically. It was something that collectively people recognized that there was value in figuring out what the good was that the most people would exchange for, and then that ultimately developed into a pricing system, and that ultimately led to the ability to have highly specialized economies and for people to benefit from trade and specialization. And so you start with that baseline that money is a necessity. And then the next question becomes, well, what's the best money? And the best money is not necessarily the same thing for every person at any point in time. Like, people will ultimately converge to that point. But, you know, the idea of, well, what is the best money for a person at a point in time? You know, a lot of people say, well, Venezuelans would be way better off if they had dollars. Well, most Venezuelans don't have access to dollars, right? And so when you think about, well, what is the best money, it has to do with, well, what is your situation, right? What, you know, every person has an A, B choice. Every person doesn't have an A, B, C, D, E, F, you know, all the way to Z choice. And so when you strip that away, it is everyone will converge to Bitcoin because it's something that they can all more reasonably access. And then when you think about the benefit of an economic system that has, you know, one common currency that spans across, you know, I'm someone who still happens to believe that there will be borders, but that at least in terms of there will be one common language because it is something that everyone can generally have access to and that can represent a common language of value. And so I do think, I don't know, you know, whether, you know, it's an event in Iran or an event in Venezuela or capital controls in Argentina, but yes, certainly each one of those events causes people to have to search for the tools that they need for self-preservation. And money is, you know, in our current worlds, you know, one of the most basic necessities. Yes, like water, food, all of those things are, but it is the tool that helps us peacefully get all of those things. And so, you know, over time, as there's more disruption in the underlying economies of many disparate places, that people will logically, when they're searching for that solution, they will gravitate to Bitcoin because it is the thing that solves the needs for so many diverse people.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So would you say that with the, you know, really accelerating development of the, you know, of the second layer technologies, you know, Lightning Network and all these issues with privacy security becoming more easier to, you know, to handle with, to use, do you see clusters of circular economies evolving, decentralized, you know, like little clusters of on Bitcoin?
Yeah, you know, and I've seen this debate quite a bit. And, you know, we need more circular economies, and it's something that I haven't spent a lot of time. Yeah, I've certainly thought about it, but it's not something that I necessarily think is something in terms of a tangible either solution or problem that we need to worry about. I do think that, you know, circularity of the Bitcoin economy is something that will happen naturally. I think that, you know, if I think about my own local economy, and that, you know, if there's, you know, 2 million people generally in the city in which I trade on a daily basis for very basic goods, that there needs to be a lot greater density of Bitcoin holding and people willing to accept Bitcoin for that to be a tangible reality. And that the first step of that process is people wanting to hold Bitcoin. And so people, you know, before, like every individual who owns Bitcoin, and generally today, it may not be the case in the future, but generally today, the way that people access Bitcoin for the first time, again, not a hard and fast rule, but safe to say greater than 90% or greater than 95%, is somebody who's converting some fiat for Bitcoin. But regardless of how they come to get Bitcoin for the first time, maybe it's maybe it is a business sold their service for Bitcoin and that's how they got Bitcoin for the first time, or maybe a friend gave them Bitcoin. But ultimately, every individual that comes to have the mental view or to have the framework that Bitcoin is money, that is the first step to them then turning around and saying, you can pay me directly in Bitcoin. And so whatever or however people come to that conclusion, that's what really matters, because once there is a great enough density of people that are, and especially in local economies, or at least in terms of the sufficient density to allow you to survive day to day, being able to go and purchase things. And I do think that will increasingly happen over time. I do think that as Bitcoin waves, you know, or is adopted generally in waves today, that over time, those people, as they become more confident in Bitcoin as a currency, they very logically, that the gap between whether I'm earning in dollars and converting it to Bitcoin or getting paid directly in Bitcoin, those two worlds begin to blend. I think the importance of a quote circular economy is more important that there are a billion people that have Bitcoin, because ultimately those billion people turn into sources of liquidity in terms of their goods and services. So what we're talking about is somebody that's willing to save in Bitcoin is then willing to sell their goods and services for Bitcoin. And even though we don't think about it today, if that sale of goods and services becomes liquidity for Bitcoin, and the more diverse, so there's two things that are important to Bitcoin's value, liquidity, but today that liquidity is not very diverse. It's probably more diverse than the liquidity is for gold, if you were living in the United States and you wanted to get euros, you basically have very few options to be able to get that liquidity that you need. But that what's most important is that about a circular economy is that the actual liquidity for Bitcoin becomes ever more diverse. You're not just going to central points to convert in and out of dollars and then using the benefit of the diversification of dollar liquidity or euro liquidity or yen liquidity. And so, but as it relates to, do we need to do things to accelerate the you know, Bitcoin's circular economy? I don't particularly think so, because, you know, and this is, this may, you know, be lending too much on my Hayekian view of, I just have this sense that, or not sense, it's based on logic and reason, that as Bitcoin evolves and as it scales, as, you know, Bitcoin goes from being held by 100 million people to 200 million people to 300 million people, the needs of those people is not static. Bitcoin isn't static. And so over time, as Bitcoin grows, the demand for the type of services will grow, the number of people working on Bitcoin will grow, and the problem that exists at the point in time that people are demanding will be solved because there's the function of demand. And so if there's 500 million people in the world that have Bitcoin and more people want to be paid in Bitcoin, then somebody's going to develop a payroll system that helps, you know, integrate and process, you know, distributions of Bitcoin to employees every 2 weeks. But that will only happen when there's a sufficient number of people within a company that want to be paid directly in Bitcoin. And so everything is a function of demand. And that's why I think that, you know, people spreading knowledge about Bitcoin and people learning about Bitcoin is the more tangible one foot in front of the other approach that everyone should be thinking about relative to, well, what are all the things that we need to exist in Bitcoin? Because just the mere fact of more people thinking about Bitcoin and working on Bitcoin and saving in Bitcoin will cause those things to develop in the normal course. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So before we wrap up, a final question. Park, you wrote pretty much lengthy in your article about, you know, that the questions of you posed the question like, when would the government or, you know, nation states feel threatened in order to think about, you know, banning or restricting or censoring or whatever Bitcoin? What is that tipping point, you think? I mean, if we tie this in, you know, maybe with the topic of censorship resistance and privacy fungibility, when do you think would that situation be? I think you asked something like, could it be with 1-3 trillion market valuation? Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I do think that this is something that, it's generally one of those things that I believe is important for people to think about, because I think that it is an inevitability. Like at some point, the, you know, governments attempt to, you know, they realize what's happening and they try to resist it in some form or fashion. And that likely doesn't apply to every person or every government, but especially for the reserve currencies, the dollar, euro, yen, a lot of power is derived through the currency. And so it would be, I think,
a question of taxation, right? So, you know, see you near Raj.
Well, taxation, but also like access, you know, like right. PayPal being able to deplatform an individual or person, or Bank of America saying, hey, sorry, you can't be my customer anymore. That is the weaponization of access to the financial system. And the same applies to, I remember there was reports a few years back when the ECB was talking about instituting negative interest rates, which by the way, are like the ultimate insanity, and should anybody that can't understand why negative interest rates don't make any sense, like that's probably the first place to start. But when banks in Europe started saying, well, okay, well, we're going to just we'll take the cash and put it in our own vaults. And, you know, well, that didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Because if you were to do that, the threat is that you get cut out of the system, right? And that's also the beautiful thing about Bitcoin, and the reason why, you know, that censorship resistant piece comes in is that, you know, everyone can connect on a permissionless basis to this network. So, you know, the two ideas there are that the power that is, you know, garnered or that materializes out of the function of the currency comes in many forms. And so, and on the reverse side of that, it comes in the form of one form of censorship or another. And that is something that is, like, I think, you know, the supply of Bitcoin, the 21 million supply and censorship resistance go hand in hand. They essentially reinforce each other. That the more valuable Bitcoin becomes, it becomes more distributed, more decentralized, and the more censorship resistant it becomes. But then, you know, the more censorship resistant it becomes, the more reliable that fixed supply it becomes. So thinking about these two systems today is one that is based on censorship and derives a lot of power from censorship, and then one is inherently decentralized, and that at the core of it must be censorship resistant. And that when you put those two realities together, it is that not that governments won't try to stop what's happening over here, but that they likely will only do that at the point in which they truly see it as a threat. And that at that point in time, the system, when they view it as a threat, is inevitably, like, and by definition, not just like theoretically, but when they view it as a threat, it is now larger, more decentralized, more valuable, you know, more censorship resistant, harder to stop. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, there is not a possibility that, you know, that censorship resistance, there's no metric system for censorship resistance, how censorship resistant is enough. The only hard and fast rule is more is better, and that, you know, over time, as Bitcoin decentralizes, that with every attack, whether it was SegWit 2x or, you know, these other competing systems where people try to explain, oh, well, this new version of Bitcoin is better, so come over here, that each attack on Bitcoin or each attempt to influence it from the outside in, and Bitcoin fending those attacks off, ultimately give it strength, that it essentially immunizes Bitcoin, that those are like, we don't have a absolute test for censorship resistance. We only have market tests, and we only get market tests as Bitcoin disrupts certain, you know, scenarios or companies or markets to cause somebody to want to try to censor it. And then when they can't, then Bitcoin grows in value because people look at it and say, okay, well, if they could overcome that, then, you know, it can overcome a lot more than that. And so ultimately, I don't know what the level is. It's probably some psychological level. It's like some relationship to gold, right? Or, you know, so I don't know, but so my view, it's more important to recognize that the fact that governments will try to do something, and they may try to do things less overtly than more overtly, you know, the likely source of it is they start to put more restrictions on the on-ramps, off-ramps, which, to your point about a circular economy, I think it's less about circularity and it's more about diversification of liquidity. But so it's important to be thinking about these future states and what governments do, because ultimately as a system, but ultimately as individuals within that system, people will have to act to create, you know, solutions to various problems to route around it. And there will be no coordination. It will happen naturally, organically, because problems are being presented. And so while it is an inevitability, I don't think it's particularly valuable to worry about, you know, does it happen when Bitcoin's at 3 trillion or 1.5 or more than the value of gold? It is, what is the actual driver for why that would happen? If I believe that it will happen, if I believe that more and more people will adopt Bitcoin, such that its value, again, we think about it in dollar terms, but ultimately it will, you know, at some point in time, it will flip. So if there's fundamental demand for Bitcoin, that there will be increasingly government attempts to restrict that, the use of that, because it restricts their ability to control power. And yeah, recognizing that in that world, what would you rather? Do you really think that, you know, you would have to have two trains of thought that would be inconsistent with each other? It is, left to its own devices, Bitcoin will be adopted by a massive amount of people. And because of that, the system as a whole will increase in value, because just by the mere fact of more people being a part of it, and that monetary network will have greater diversity of liquidity. Like, that is the ultimate value of the network.
And the more important would be the usage of full nodes. I mean, you mentioned that in your article, you urged, or you said somehow it's really important that more and more people, right? Am I correct?
Yeah, I think, well, so, and this is probably a little bit, you know, I think, you know, there's, I think the benefit is that, you know, I have a certain view, and my view may not be entirely consistent with the majority of people, but, you know, there's often a view that people that are, quote, Bitcoin maximalists, or people that think that Bitcoin will be a global reserve currency, all think alike, but there's actually a pretty solid degree of disagreement when people look at, you know, underneath the hood. But I do think that there's two things. I think the keys are more important than nodes, because keys are more static than nodes. If somebody else has my Bitcoin key, then some action has to be taken. And, well, it's not my key. They're holding my Bitcoin and they have their own key. And they can choose to either grant me access or not. That is static and absolute. If I want that relationship to change, I'm dependent on somebody else. And so I think that Bitcoin is ultimately more secure and more decentralized, and less at risk, more resilient, more anti-fragile, the more keys that exist. Because if, you know, one of the ways to think about nodes is it's important that everyone can run a node and that everyone can validate their, you know, yeah, that the deposits, yeah, that they're receiving are consistent with the rules of Bitcoin as they understand it.
Exactly.
But yeah, tomorrow, it's like, when is a node actually working? Because is it only when I'm validating on it that the Bitcoin that are received to the address are actually there? Or is it providing value to the rest of the network perpetually by putting up all these gates of having, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of assayers of Bitcoin that ultimately create a disincentive for people to subvert the rules? And so, you know, keys and nodes are both important. In my view, it's because keys are more static, and if somebody else holds your keys, you are dependent on some other action. I can have my keys and not have a full node and go get a computer, download software, and spool up a new node. If somebody, you know, came to my place of business and shut it down, if I have my keys in diverse locations backed up, then I could go get those keys, spin up a new node. If I don't have access to my keys, the node is no good to me, right? And so I think both serve functions. Both are important. There could be a tragedy of the commons where, you know, sufficient people aren't running nodes, and that if that's the case and sufficient number of people aren't holding their keys, then a large custodian or a group of large custodians could then enforce or influence the rules of Bitcoin and either take, you know, a large controlling share of the economic value to some other subset of rules. And so that's why, ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, it's why, you know, I think most people, the longer that they stay in Bitcoin, the more likely they are to hold their own keys, the more likely they are to run their own nodes. Mm-hmm. I kind of think about it without getting political too much, just talking like theory. It's kind of like the purpose of the Second Amendment in the United States, where, you know, you can agree or disagree, and people have various different ranges of like how they think about it. But at the end of the day, at least how I think about it is, and I'm not, you know, I wish I owned more guns, but you know, the purpose of it is, there's 400 million guns in the United States and there's only 300 million people. The possibility that a corrupt government tries to extract its will on the people is, there's a much lower probability that happens because there's so many guns distributed throughout the United States. Right. And I think about keys in Bitcoin the same way, that the more distributed the economic value within the Bitcoin network is, and actually at a key level, the less likely the network as a whole is to be attacked coercively, because when people look at that, they, you know, if all the Bitcoin were held by 200 keys or 200 parties, it'd be easy to go pick off those 200 parties or get sufficient number of them. But if they look around the world and they say they're, you know, and I, as a proxy for this, I look at the number of outputs. So I've seen some competing numbers, but it's something like 60 million to 90 million outputs. The greater number of outputs, if you have a Bitcoin key, if you want to have your own UTXO, you have to have your own Bitcoin key, essentially. And the more UTXOs there are, you know, the more distributed, if 21 million is a fixed number, as the number of UTXOs increases over time, as adoption increases and as more people have their own keys, then ultimately the actual economic value of Bitcoin becomes more and more distributed. And it's like there's guns spread out throughout the country. They're like, if you want to attack this network, you've got to figure out how to play the game of whack-a-mole that is, you know, 60 to 90 million unspent outputs, and they can pop up anywhere in the world because they can download open source software. Their node doesn't have to be constantly running. It doesn't even have to be the same node. You just have to be able to connect anywhere to the network. And so I do think, nodes are important, but nodes and keys really kind of work hand in hand. And I think if there's something that's more important, it is keys, but everyone would be better off if people were running nodes and having their own keys.
Yeah, I guess, when the user experience improves also, there's a discussion going on constantly on Twitter. Also, I think with Peter McCormick, I agree with him. It's not easy, people don't have the time to, to study, to educate themselves. There's a technical intellectual level of required for this kind of thing. And if it's a plug and play, of course, people would just buy it, use it, and strengthen the network and keep the consensus rules intact. So,
I think that, the other piece of that is that, I did listen to Peter McCormick and Matt talking about this on their year-end review. I think that Matt brought up a good point, is that, part of it is the economic side of being able to validate your own, that your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin. But the other point about it is it's a layer of increasing privacy. And that ultimately that, your ability to both accept Bitcoin and validate Bitcoin in entirely detached of any other individual or any other party ultimately makes Bitcoin more censorship resistant. I think that, recognizing that, and then also recognizing that there is no static level or sufficient level of censorship resistance. There's only market tests, and there's only the fundamental principle that more is better. That it certainly makes Bitcoin more resilient the easier it is for both people to run nodes, but then also the more practical it is in a standard application. I know a lot of people are working on this, and I was talking to Christopher Allen last night, who's working on a few applications. It's, I have a node, full node running, but then making it easy for me to connect my wallets or to have my node. It's like most people don't store their Bitcoin on their Bitcoin full node or on their Bitcoin D. And so you need to have the ability to have your node that is static and that's consistently up, but that that the way that you actually store Bitcoin and in terms of the devices that are or the wallets that are generating addresses are connecting with those two nodes, and they're actually separate, because people don't, I think increasingly people will move to multi-sig solutions as the value of Bitcoin becomes greater and the value at risk becomes greater. But then to have those type of storage systems connected to full nodes and communicating with full nodes that individuals run, so that if they operate as essentially kind of watching certain addresses, that they'll be able to marry, you know, okay, this is the way that I want to store my Bitcoin, but I also want to be able to validate and you know, receive or confirm or send with my own node. And so I think over time that the integration of those two things, essentially, you know, recognizing that they likely will be distinct and different, but then integrating them to make it more plug and play and easy for technical users to be able to deploy. I think that is an inevitability. It just will take time, but it will also result in Bitcoin being stronger, more censorship resistant, and more decentralized.
All right. Yeah. So, that's about it. Parker, thanks so much for your time. I have taken up enough time of yours. Any other information, like, want to plug in, like, I'm going to put your Twitter handle and your Unchained Capital website. Are there any resources people can look up?
No, I think that's pretty much it. Parker A. Lewis on Twitter. Not just my own content, but Phil writes some solid content, yeah. And Dhruv does as well. So you can always find us at the Unchained Capital blog. Just wish everyone Happy New Year. The Genesis block anniversary was yesterday. So I think 2020 is going to be a really exciting year. I don't know if the halvening is priced in, but I'm sure not going to wait around and
right. Happy New Year to you too. I'm really looking forward to your next articles. Really excited to, you know, but you know, it's, you know, you'll surprise us, I guess.
Should have one out in the next week.
All right. Looking forward to that. So Happy New Year. And thank you so much again, Parker. Hope to talk to you soon.
We can finally do this. All right.
Have a good day. Bye-bye. See you. Yeah.
Hey. So what you guys think? I hope you enjoyed it and loved it as much as I did. My talk, my interview with Parker Lewis from Unchained Capital. His articles, I mean, his comprehension and knowledge level is really adorable and really fascinating. So check out his articles on Unchained Capital. I'm going to put up the link. I really appreciate if you share, retweet, repost, or whatever, or give me a positive review on any podcast platform. And let me know any kind of feedback, questions for next time, because I'm planning to do, you know, really more of these special, you know, episodes where we really go down the rabbit hole and educate people, you know, about why Bitcoin and the essence, the purpose, the vision, and, you know, the fundamental, the properties, and why is it also an absolute and inevitable necessity for, you know, for humanity, for freedom, for prosperity and a monetary revolution on every level you can think of. So, again, my name is Kevin Navani. I'll talk to you soon again. Thanks so much for listening, for your support, and have a good day. Bye.